As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Will Chamberlain was the most dominant and the greatest center to ever play the game, bar none. I mean, I'd love, you know, you could talk about Kareem and you could talk about Shaq, and you talk about Hakeem Olajuwon. There is any, there's no one that is close to what Will Chamberlain did in his career. And so when people start talking about this, it's crazy. And basketball is not a game of one-on-one. This is not tennis. They're not going out there and playing against one another. Occasionally that there's a one-on-one situation, but it's team basketball. And the best teams are the ones that win championships. Not the best individual.
Right in your podcast face.
This is Nerdish, She Wrote, with your host, Dave Dufour.
With Moe DeKeel.
Are you ready to be entertained?
And Seth Partnow.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic NBA Show. It's Friday. It's Nerdish, She Wrote. And for some reason, Seth Partnow is reclined while we're starting this podcast. I think we just got to get his attention up, Mo. I'm Dave Dufour. Seth Partnow is in Boston for the Sloan Analytics Conference. Mo DeKeel is in L.A. because, you know, he likes nice weather.
It's the greatest city in the world. We have unbelievable weather in February and March. I'm sitting outside enjoying myself. It's lovely outside. So, you know, it's just the greatest city in the world. I got food. If I want to go skiing, I can go to the mountains. If I want to go to the beach. But I don't want any of y'all to come. Just keep your asses out. There's too many of y'all.
I thought you were about to break into Hamilton lyrics talking about the greatest city in the world.
I would never. I could. That is, let me tell you, on the list of things that I have not watched, that's on there. I mean, I'm no interest whatsoever in that.
Your loss.
That's not for me. All right, you guys want to talk some hoops?
This is how you can tell Dave does not have children, because he has not seen Encanto.
Oh yeah, I haven't seen that. I haven't seen most of it. I mean, I've said this before on this podcast. Everything is just derivative. They're going to reboot White Men Can't Jump.
Which is, no, let me go on a rant. I got it. No, clear out. Clear out. Okay, because this pisses me off. I'm literally sending a tweet and not listening to the podcast.
Literally about that topic as you're saying it. So just clear out.
We don't freaking need it. Okay? And we need to stop doing movies. We need to stop doing reboots of movies that don't need a reboot. We need to stop doing sequels for movies that were 20, 30, 40 years ago. Okay? We saw how badly the Coming to America sequel was. Right?
No, we didn't.
Well, if you just say, be happy you didn't see it. Because Coming to America, unbelievable movie. The sequel, god awful. And I wanted it to be good so badly. But they're going to do Beetlejuice 2? No, I don't care that Keaton's coming back and Winona Ryder's coming back. We don't need that. And now I wake up today to seeing the greatest basketball movie of all time. I'm not here for debates. I'm not listening to you. Anybody come at me with that, I'm blocking your ass. The greatest basketball movie of all time, White Man Can't Jump, and we're going to reboot it? We don't need to reboot it. Just put it back in the theater. That's it. Plain and simple. Re-release it.
Thank you, Mo.
Okay, I'm done. I'll talk to y'all later.
No notes. Yeah. No notes. Thank you. Perfect take. No notes.
That's Mo DeKeel. Just want to make sure everybody, when they steal that, he takes some credit for that. Okay, this is going to be a hatery episode. I hate it. So I want to start with Ja Morant because I love Ja Morant, whose father was his biggest hater. He's had quite a season so far. Wouldn't you guys say? This guy is nuts.
Of course, your favorite thing. It's two things. It's one of two things every week. It's either Ja Morant or the Cleveland Cavaliers. It's one or the other, and it's just flip a coin, everybody. I'm bringing heat today, folks. Be ready.
Everybody knows I only watch Ja Morant and the Cavs. So I actually throw the Timberwolves in there as well. Those are the only teams I watch. But in particular with Ja Morant, it just feels like this guy has taken another leap in the last month. And he is now unstoppable. Watching these games the last few days, you know, he had that 46-point game. He had a crazy 52-point game where the fact that he scored 52 points was probably like the third thing that came up from that game, because he also dunked Jakob Poeltl into the earth. And then he hit on a beautiful pass from Steven Adams. Got to say that. Maybe Nashville needs to call Memphis about their quarterback situation. But Ja Morant has this great floating catch in the air, turnaround buzzer beater. I mean, it's just an incredible performance from a guy who continues to leave us all awestruck because he's not big like we're used to seeing a guy dominate. But I want to talk about the way he's been doing it. He gets to the basket. They're triple teaming him in this game. The Spurs were sending a triple team trying to get him to give up the ball, and he turns it into a layup. This is every possession. He drives 21 times a game. It's just unbelievable for their offense. And what has happened this season is you will see teams, they're scared of the drive. They know. I mean, they saw him in the playoffs last year. They saw he's got that great floater. He can finish really well in traffic. He's 65% inside 5 feet. He takes 9 shots a game inside of 5 feet. He's third in the league, right behind Giannis and LeBron. I mean, this guy, what he is doing, getting to the basket, is nuts. It doesn't make any sense, and you can't go under or leave him open anymore from three. 34% on his pull-ups this year. Pretty good. 38.5% on wide-open threes. That's, you know, we've talked about that ad nauseum here. We only count the ones that are charted as wide open, and even that with a grain of salt. But he is making his threes. Ja Morant's unstoppable. Why can't Ja Morant take the Grizzlies to the finals, guys?
So big part of the Grizzlies' success, and this is something that's come up a lot recently. Big part of the Grizzlies' success is, okay, Ja is, you know, playing on that, I don't know, right now would he be second team all NBA, maybe knocking on the door first legitimately, like depending on how much, like what you think of Chris Paul missing the rest of the regular season, probably. He's been legitimately awesome. Like, there's no question about that. But the other half of their success is they play no bad players. Aside from kind of Zaire Williams getting some sort of developmental minutes, and he's been playing better recently as well. They don't play any bad, but what they don't have is, you know, we like Jaren Jackson, we like Desmond Bain, but they don't have enough other high-level talent. And the fact that their 12th guy is much better than their playoff opposition's 12th guy just won't matter in the playoffs. So, yeah, in any given series, Ja has a good chance of being the best player. But against a lot of other good playoff teams, the second, third, fourth, maybe fifth, maybe sixth best player in the series are all not going to be Grizzlies. So if you want a reason why, that's the reason why.
Right, but I'm going to go another level to you. I don't trust them to get stops at the end of games when a team has a perimeter player. Like, that's the thing. Go back and watch their loss to Minnesota when D'Angelo Russell went off and had, you know, I think 23 points in the fourth quarter, and they simply could not stop him. And we could talk about, oh, they don't have Dylan Brooks or whatever. He's a foul machine, right? And he's going to end up getting fouled out in those scenarios and things like that. I think that's their the real thing, if you just want to pinpoint one thing. Seth is 100% right, and I just piggyback on his point. And then behind that is, I don't trust them. End of game scenario, we're going to be able to get a stop, and mainly, especially if it's a perimeter guy coming at you, and that's going to be a problem for them when they face Golden State in close games. That's going to be a problem for them when they play Phoenix. But them going to the conference finals, I would not at all be shocked, and I'm not far away yet from predicting it, but right now I think they're pretty damn close.
That's a team that honestly could have used Torrey Craig, right? Like they need one of those type of guys, a guy who could, you know, be a little bit big on the perimeter. Desmond Bane hasn't been able to do it. I mean, Mo, we watched that game together the other night, and that was our big takeaway. They don't have a guy who can go get you a stop. Yeah. All right, guys.
I mean, Dylan Brooks is sort of that, like, the issue is one that some other teams too. It's one of balance. Sure. Like if they're playing at the 2 and the 3, D'Anthony Melton and Dylan Brooks, that's two pretty good defenders, but now they don't have enough shooting. So they have sort of a similar problem to what I think Miami, not to jump around, but Miami's going to have in the playoffs, is the balance between defense and shooting. And Memphis is geared more towards the offense, Miami geared more towards the defense. But I think that is a problem both of those teams are going to have in the postseason, is finding those balanced lineups to where you have enough on both ends to be able to not just play situationally, but to play, you know, fourth quarter, 4 minute stretches without getting subs.
All right. Mo, what's your favorite thing this week?
Oh, my absolute favorite thing, Dave. And I love this with all my heart when I watch basketball games, you know, especially close games, right? And it's a situation where you're up 3 and there's a minute 30 left, and you decide as an offense, we're not going to do anything for the first 15 to 16 seconds of this shot clock, because we're going to bleed the clock. That's my favorite thing, Dave. I see that and I just sit back and go, oh, yeah, they're playing the classics. It's so incredible for me. I get so happy because it's so stupid. Okay. And sometimes you just see stupidity and you just got to laugh. And you watch it and we're seeing it more and more. Teams are not able to hold these leads because of what they're doing in that stuff when they're playing that way. And it's funny how often teams go away from what was working in the last 2 minutes to bleed clock. Hey, score more points. You're up 3. That's a 1-possession ball game. It's a minute 30 left. There's at least 3 more possessions for the other team. I'll let the math guy figure that part out. But, you know, it's when you're looking at all those things, it just doesn't make sense. Go get a bucket. You know why the Suns are so good in crunch time situations? They don't bleed the clock. Now, they might take a while to get into their stuff, but they're running their stuff. They're not waiting till 8 seconds on the shot clock to finally get DeAndre Ayton to set the screen. They're going right into their action because they understand, hey, if we're up by more possessions and there's less possessions for the other team, we're probably going to win if we don't do anything stupid. But, you know, I love it, Dave. I really do.
Well, the Suns do bleed the clock. But not with a live ball, right? Like, it's the Chris Paul, it's the Nikola Jokic, let me burn as much clock as I can before the clock starts running. And then once the clock runs, I mean, we all know, roll the ball up the court, Chris Paul's going to let it roll up. He wants the shot clock because he's going to try to orchestrate some offense. Look, we've podcasted together for what, like 6 years now? At least 5?
God, that long?
It's been a long time. And our number one complaint is,
they've had hair when you guys started.
Yeah, exactly.
No, he didn't. Come on now. Let's not lie to the
too
people.
Too iconic. Everyone knows. But one of our big complaints was, when is it okay to stop just playing basketball? Your game plan should be your game plan. Why you would just pull up when you're up 5 points? It just doesn't make any sense to me. Come on. Run the score up. Seth, what do the numbers say?
Well, this is something that comes up a lot, is a stat that I've repeated repeatedly, is that every second earlier you get into your offense on a possession is worth a point of offensive rating. The shot clock is the defense's friend. So, and what I mean by that, it's not how early in the shot clock you take the shot. It's like however you want to measure, whether it's getting the ball across half court, getting the ball across the hash mark, getting the ball inside the arc for the first time. Any number of ways. I've looked at this any number of ways. And it basically says that even like controlling for, like even removing fast breaks from the equation, in the half court, you get into your offense at 18. Your offensive rating on that possession is 5 points higher than it would be if you get into at 13. Now, you know, that's on a single possession basis, that's a 20th of a point. But if you're bleeding 10 seconds of the clock every time, that's a 10th of a point every possession. And yeah, you're the amount you're gaining by possibly shaving one possession off the rest of the game is not nearly as much as you're losing by not scoring. You know, the best way to, you know, the best way to make the game shorter is just to get buckets. You know, oh, like, you know, it's not, okay, well, man, they have, it's a three possession game with 60 seconds left. You know what would be even better? A four possession game with 55 seconds left.
It's just common sense, really. But for whatever reason, we don't allow that to apply in the last 2 minutes. You know, whether it's coaches, whether it's players that think they're smart and doing the right thing, it just doesn't. And here's the important thing, too, guys. It's you run your first action. The defense does a good job defending it. Cool. You still have time to run another action and get back into it, you know, and put more pressure on the defense. If you allow a defense to, in a 24-second shot clock situation, to take 16 seconds off, whatever, 14 seconds off, they get to chill. You're not putting any pressure on them. You're not putting any stress on them. You're not creating a possibility where, like, oh, there might be a switch and we're going to screw that up and somebody's going to be open. It's just simple stuff. So every time I see it, I just know, cool, this game's going to be really close towards the end because the other team's playing like an idiot.
And this is important because I think what he's describing as the mechanism for it is that increase in offensive rating by getting to your offense early. It's not just from shooting earlier. Like if you get in your offense at 18 and you end up shooting with 7 on the clock, you're probably getting a better shot than if you got into the offense at 12 and are shooting with 7 on the clock because of what Mo's talking about. You run the one action, you get the defense in rotation, you chip away. This is the old, like, the Spurs approach or like the Utah blender. The Utah blender where it's no one guy is just, it's breaking everyone down, but it's a small chip and you turn into a bigger gap and then all of a sudden you have a dunk or a layup or a wide open three, and you give yourself the chance. You give the defense a chance to screw up. Basically, the more time you give yourself to run actions, the more things you make a defense contend with. And yeah, what's happening in this prevent offense is, okay, you have to guard one thing. You have to guard one thing where you know what's coming. You know who's doing what where. And if you stop that, then they're going to break into an ISO, and you're going to have to contest a mid-range jumper without fouling. And it's like, okay, NBA players can score in that situation some, but it's hard.
It's like the Spurs with that great shot instead of a good shot, and they do it every single possession. Good teams want more possessions. They should, at least. You're gonna score more points, most likely. If you're a better team than your opponent, more possessions plays into your advantage. So push it.
No, you can be judicious about the shots you're taking.
Right. Just like, take good shots.
There's theoretically good shots that you might get, like an open, like a good shooter with a semi-contested look from three early in the shot clock. Be like, you know what, we'll work it a little bit, get a better one than that. It may change that calculus a little bit, but it's not just I'm going to put the ball on my hip and wait.
You want to go ahead and slide right into your favorite thing this week?
My favorite thing is the warm glow that embraces me whenever the player tiers get updated as they did this week.
Oh yeah, and we're gonna talk about those in a minute. But I said this was a very hatery episode of the show, and Hall of Fame hater Rick Barry. I hope by now you've seen the video. If you're listening to this, you've seen the video that's floating around the internet. Rick Barry was asked over All-Star break, you know, what he thought about the modern game. And I think it's worth a listen, especially if you are a basketball person like we are. Like, we're basketball people, not just NBA.
We're talking about the 75.
Well, you should get the officials. Get the officials to call it by the rule book.
Okay.
Stop the traveling. Stop the carrying the ball. Stop the moving screens. Call the damn game according to the rule book, because players will adjust. If you're going to allow them to get away with it, hell, of course I'll keep doing it. Call the game according to the rule book. It's such an advantage to let a guy carry the basketball or take an extra step. That's ridiculous, you know, or a guy to move on offense. I mean, why are you giving all this advantage to guys? They're breaking the rules. Call the game according to the rule book. I charted a game a few years ago, Chicago, Atlanta. 59 moving screens weren't called. 59. That's insane. I can't even tell you how many times they carried the ball, how many times they traveled with the ball. It's pathetic. For me to watch this game the way I was taught how to play the game and to watch this and what they allow to let go, it's an embarrassment. I'm sorry, it is. It's an incredible game. The athletes are incredible. What they can do is incredible. But they're getting away with murder. And I blame the officials. Call the damn game accordingly. And it's the same thing with screens. I mean, I'll give you a little lesson here, okay? You hear even the coaches, when I'm hearing the coaches saying, well, he didn't set a very good screen. Trust me, guys, a player doesn't set a screen. Doesn't say when you have to set something and implies that you need to do something, you have to set a screen. That's not your responsibility. Your responsibility, as my teammate for Clifford Ray, let's say, is to learn to put yourself in the most advantageous position to allow me to take my man and run my man into him, thereby making him a screener. He's a stationary object. He only becomes a screener if I run my man into him. So if I do a crappy job of setting my man up and he's going to come over the screen, what does he think? Well, I'm supposed to set a screen. So he moves a little bit to try to what? Set a screen. That's a violation. It's a moving screen. It's a foul. Officials don't call it unless you take a guy's head off. That's the problem with the pick and roll play. They don't run it properly. They don't understand it properly. And even the coaches are talking not intelligently.
The funniest thing to come out of it is that he said he scouted a game and he counted 59 moving screens. And I don't know. I think I watched that game. I mean, it could have been any regular season NBA game. He is not wrong about any of this stuff. There is a lot of carrying the ball, although, hang on, I don't know if that's a bad thing. Moving screens, traveling, he's right about all of it. I don't know if it matters, though. How do you guys feel about it?
Go ahead, Mo.
No, Seth, I'll let you go because you're the one that was waving your hands.
Yeah, so this is something that kind of comes up from time to time when people like the expression, that's not basketball. What does that mean? There's no basketball is not a naturally occurring phenomenon in the world. It is a game that is wholly made up, wholly constructed. And as such, if you want the game to be different, you can either formally or informally change the rules. So there's two arguments that are going on here. One of them is sort of a purist argument, and I think that's complete bullshit. Then the other one is an aesthetic argument, and I'm here for that. Like if there's things you like to watch, things you don't like to watch, that's a taste issue. And now we're talking about, you know, more of the business of basketball, which of these makes most sense as an entertainment product. And I think we've gone back and forth about some of the things we do and don't like, but that's an aesthetic taste judgment, not a something you can win by saying that's not basketball. Back in my day, rabble, rabble, rabble.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I mean, look, if you want to split hairs about it, and I describe it this way. The NBA is a basketball product. That's not basketball necessarily. It is their version of basketball. So the rules changes. I mean, the rules are different in the NBA than just about everywhere else. Plain and simple. But it is mostly done that way for television because most basketball games aren't played for a television audience. There are things. I mean, I'm sorry, like 59 moving screens. If you called that, I don't know that they all go away because there were a lot of moving screens that used to be called. I mean, there's a lot of moving screens that are called in every level of basketball except for the NBA. And I don't want to watch that on television. I don't like free throws. The Philadelphia 76ers are going to be a hard watch for me because, you know, I have respect for my own time. I like to do fun stuff and basketball is fun. Free throws aren't. So I don't want them to call any of that stuff. But the arguments that he's making, that according to the rules of basketball that we all grew up playing, he's right.
I love that you're giving Seth a migraine right now as we were talking. It was great. I wish this was a video product for people to see the facial expressions made from Seth. No, listen, the stuff I like that he was saying was, you know, we do need to start officiating the game properly with everything and things that go with it. And I think that's an important comment there. You just saw how different the game looked earlier in the season when they weren't calling the fouls at the way they used to and things like that. We're starting to trend a little bit dangerously close back to what it used to be. But just when you let defense do things, it makes a big difference, right? You let the defense actually, you know, defend goes a long way with that stuff. The funny thing here about the travel in particular, I don't remember when the gather came into the lexicon of basketball. You have a gather and then two steps. Mm-hmm. I don't know when the rule changed or was tweaked or whatnot. Because I'm going to tell you this much. It was never talked about when I was in the NBA. We never talked gather. Now, we talked about how to cheat a little bit and move your feet a little quicker, right, and shuffle and get away with it. But we weren't thinking gather and then two steps, you know, and that's something that's kind of evolved lately. So I understand where that's coming from. The screen stuff and the stuff he was talking about on the screens, what's really important about it that's going to get missed in the conversation, because, you know, as Seth said in our chat group, you know, old man yells at clouds. So everybody's going to look at it that way with Rick Barry. The important thing is he's talking about guards are not setting up and coming off the screens properly. They're not waiting for their big man to be set. A lot of times when offensive fouls happen off of a screen, an illegal screen is called, it's because the guard went too quickly. And he described it perfectly. And then the big man has to adjust because he feels like he has to set a screen so that he doesn't get taken out of the game. That's an important aspect there that we don't get a lot of, is the guards are losing the patience on some of those things. But he's not wrong in that, you know, we've kind of ventured away from that. And you're not wrong, Dave, in the sense of, like, I don't want to see all these free throws and all these fouls called and 59 moving screens.
Yeah.
But this is something that we've talked about forever. We talked about this during the Golden State run with, you know, the next perfect screen Andrew Bogut sets will be the first perfect screen set screen that Andrew Bogut sets. We've seen a lot of it. So it's kind of like, I understand where he's coming from in that sense. I don't know if I'd be like, I can't watch the game because
of it. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, again, he, you know, just being a hater. But not to make everything about Ja Morant, but one of the things Ja is very good at, and he's got great screeners, is that he does have patience in the pick and roll and find the screens. And on the gather thing, look, the travels are out of control. Catch and shoot jump shots now, it's four steps, especially in transition. Anybody pulling up is traveling. The step back is crazy. If that's cool with you, then that's fine. It's not necessarily cool with me, but I also can't sit here and complain about it because it's probably better for television that Steph Curry can take four shots and hit a 30-footer. That's cooler than calling for a travel. I'm sorry. I'd rather live in the cool zone in basketball, not in real life.
I think the gather is as much a codification of sort of how things – like, I think –
spirit
honestly,
of the game.
I think Magic was probably the first, like when the big ball handler started to come into play, is where guys with like high dribbles and, you know, can cover a lot of ground and manipulate the ball a couple times before making a play. Like it had already, like Magic was a guy who dribbled high, took a lot of steps, and you couldn't, like, when did he pick the ball? I don't know when he picked the ball up. And so it's now just as much about like codifying. I remember learning even when I was in high school that like take that like one big last dribble, you can get away with a lot of extra movement because I'm still dribbling and then I took two steps and laid it in. And so I think that is sort of the gather is an attempt to codify sort of something about how basketball has developed. We can argue again. I think this is an aesthetic argument. I think we're all in agreement that we like basketball better when there's a good balance between offense and defense. And for the most part, I don't think like the sort of the happy feet traveling. And by the way, that's not a new thing. You can go back and watch like Charles Barkley, like mid post, he catches the ball at the elbow and suddenly he's jab stepping behind the arc without dribbling. So this is something that's been around forever. But I don't think that the happy step travel bothers us in terms of the competitive balance between offensive and defense, as much as we've talked about the illegal screening stuff since we've been doing this pod, like giving defenders a chance to take away advantage, because it's too easy. If the screener can reverse pivot and set an 8-foot wide screen, it's easy to create an advantage every time. And then now it's just, oh, the offense is just scoring every time. And that's not as interesting as it is when, you know, and the changes they've made this year, I think, have been good. Like, offense is dialed back a little bit this year. We're not at the 90s, but it's not quite as turbocharged as it was last year. And that's better for my tastes.
Look, if Rick Barry had played basketball after Magic Johnson, he'd be doing all this stuff too. Sorry. Just how it is. I carry the ball every single time I dribble because of Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan.
And the other thing is also that should be mentioned is the Eurostep is something that has made this the whole kind of thing, because that was just right. Like, you know, that was something we didn't see in the NBA except on accident, basically before Manu Ginobili. And that
– oh, Sarunas Marshallonis would like a
Michael
word.
Jordan would like a word. I mean, but we could do this all day. I mean, there's probably a guy in the 70s that did the Eurostep. I'm going to sit here.
No,
and
they didn't
it.
Play basketball in the 70s, Dave. That didn't exist.
Well, Rick Barry certainly did not ever Eurostep. For the record, just I want to make sure that's on record. We know that didn't happen.
I want Rick Barry to coach a team and see how he has to do it.
We can't do this. And see it. Ice Cube, give him a call. Do that big three. Rick Barry is a big three coach. Would be pretty fun.
At one time, you called Will Chamberlain a loser.
I was wrong in doing that. I think that if you had to analyze all of the centers who have played the game before, as far as basketball skills are concerned, there's never been anybody to accomplish what Will Chamberlain has accomplished. And he was an incredible human being, an incredible physical specimen, and a great athlete. And I don't think anybody will come along who will be able to match the records that Wilt has accomplished. He just never had the personnel like Bill Russell had to go along with him. And I really regret saying that in my book. I really do.
Rick, I know you hate questions like this, so I can't resist asking you one. If you have one player in NBA history that you could start a team around, who would it be?
I don't hate questions like that. It would be Will Chamberlain.
Why?
Because he's the greatest big man in the history of the game. And you win with big men. And Wilt would adapt his game accordingly. If Wilt had the good fortune of having as many great teammates as Bill Russell had, I think that his record of championships would have been phenomenal. If you look and you see what he accomplished when he was surrounded by great people, the 67 Sixer team, everybody talks about that being maybe one of the greatest teams ever, and what happened? Wilt helped them win a championship because he had great personnel. Then, when he was even older, he played on the Lakers team, and they set the record for consecutive wins. One championship, I mean, why? Because Wilt was willing to do whatever is necessary. Heck, he led the league in assists one time as a center. This guy was a phenomenon. I mean, 50 points a game for an entire season, guys. I don't know if people have an idea just how crazy that is. I mean, I played the game and scored like 36 or 7. I think I have to score 12, 13, 14 more points a game for 80-something games. That's insane. 22.5 rebounds a game average for a season.
All right, Seth, it's your favorite thing in the world, your tears, the day where we all come together to yell at you and ask why you hate our favorite player. Why do you hate LeBron James now, Seth? What is happening here?
Hold on. I feel bad for everybody else. I get to yell at Seth every day. I don't need a tears to come out. I just get to yell. I yell at him constantly.
That's true.
But that's all. So go on, though, Seth. Why do you hate
LeBron? Why do you hate LeBron James?
What did he do to you?
So, yes, by saying that at this point in his career, into his late 30s, that there are three players in the league that I think are not enormously but definitively better in terms of winning a championship than him. And those three players are Nikola Jokic, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and Kevin Durant. Tell me I'm wrong. Tell me why I'm wrong. Other than but LeBron. And but LeBron has been a strong argument forever. But I said before the year when I was doing my tiers coming into this year that the adding Russell Westbrook to his team was going to be the biggest challenge for can LeBron carry anybody to a top level, to a competitive level team. And I think we've seen the answer, and the answer is a definitive no. And so I at this point, it could change. They could make a run. They could get in the playoffs. They could win the play-in tournament. They could scare somebody in the first round. Maybe they could even win a first-round series. If that all happens, I'll change my mind. But based on what we've seen this year and the fact that Father Time is undefeated, I'm going to go out on a limb and say Father Time has at least started to do his work on what is one of the two or three greatest players of all time.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
I'm not disagreeing with you about LeBron. I am disagreeing with you about Joel Embiid. He should be in the top. It should be a four in the list. And okay. And I'm just going to point this out. And this is just the important thing there, because everything you just said, and we talk about this a lot in the MVP race when we compare Jokic and Embiid, and we go like both those teams have like the same record. When Embiid is on the floor this year with the Sixers, and this is before James Harden got there, they are 31-15. He is exactly the type of guy you just described, and for me, should be in the 1A group. That's really my only quibble with your whole list. Now, I'm going to make fun of you on other things because it's fun to do that, but really, that's the only one where I just said, I disagree with this, and it should be four. I'm not saying anybody should be moved out of the top three, but it should be four in the 1A group, and I feel like Embiid should have been put into that scale with those guys, because that's exactly what he's doing on the level of those players.
So I hear that, and I struggled with that one specifically, and I think the gap between them is, I think that Nikola Jokic is, aside from like the flagrant foul to end his postseason last year, has basically an unimpeachable playoff resume, and Embiid was very good last year, and he's had some very good series. He hasn't quite like this postseason. If he plays at the level he's playing now in the postseason, it's a no-brainer. I'm saying, as of right now, having not seen that little bit of postseason, is just enough to be. And partially, it's a style thing. Like Jokic can, you know, if his guards are bad, Jokic can take the inbound pass, bring the ball up the floor, and do everything. Embiid, like, I didn't blame Embiid for this, but you saw in the bubble playoffs when there was no Ben Simmons, like he was good when he got the ball, but he couldn't get the ball enough. And that's not his fault, but at the same time, that is just enough to knock him down that much in terms of being the guy who can really just absolutely context agnostic carry a team. So yes, am I splitting hairs? Absolutely. But that's the hair I'm splitting.
You're supposed to split hairs. You're doing this tiers ranking thing. So You know, you're supposed to split hairs, but I'm going to split hairs the other way and just say, you're wrong.
You know what?
Move on.
No, it's, you know, that was one of the harder choices in there was whether to put Embiid on 1A or 1B. And I think we've laid out both sides of that pretty well.
And you only released four tiers. I'm assuming end of the season, we'll get the full five tiers. And it also feels like, I mean, and you know, just if you guys haven't read it yet over at The Athletic, go and read it. You lay out very clearly why you had to kind of cut it off, because it seems like there's going to be too many guys now that are meeting this criteria. There's just a bunch of really good young guys.
It's not just that. It's just, it's, you know, part of it is like I've sort of artificially limited myself to 125, and empirically, like the number of players who kind of reach a certain threshold in a year is, you know, somewhere between 110, 140 or something any given year. And 125 is a nice round number. But if I was just like making a list of guys who I would consider, I think I had 161 names on that list. And I didn't really – like I laid out a couple of the examples like, oh, would I rather have Will Barton or Kyle Kuzma? At the end of the year when I have time to sit down and look at it, like that's a distinction I'm maybe more willing to make. But it seemed like – it was frankly something that I just didn't feel like I had the time to really dig into at that level of granularity. And so, and really like those, that like tier five, which is about the 70, usually the 75th to 125th or so best players, like those guys matter, but not nearly as much as kind of, you know, tier four and up is the stars and the elite role players. And I feel like those are the guys who most matter towards winning a championship.
Were there any like big surprises to you as far as like jump?
Oh, wait. One question. Was player 162 RJ Barrett?
No. He's in the 161. And then, you know, we're talking about that. Like it's come up recently, like something he's done recently that could make me think more highly of him is he's a guy who doesn't shoot well from the mid range, doesn't finish especially well at the basket. But he gets there a fair amount, and he's been getting to the free throw line a ton recently. And so a guy who's not a great all-court scorer finding a way to get himself some more easy points. And Dave just talked about how much he dislikes free throws. But like from an effectiveness standpoint,
like
if he's getting to the line 8, 10, 12 times a game with some regularity, that's the kind of thing that makes me think differently of a player. In terms of players who've made big jumps, I mean, Ja was the guy who obviously made just a huge leap. Anfernee Simons is probably a guy who in the last, and maybe I'm overreacting to like the last 2 months or so, but the fact that like they trade CJ McCollum and he's instantly just an absolute bucket is like, okay, well, that's sort of an addition by, not an addition by subtraction, but we're not losing anything to trade CJ because Anfernee Simons is right there ready to do all the same stuff.
And Anfernee Simons was at one point in the running for like the worst player in the league. He was off. I mean, he was very young not calling him the worst player in the league, but he was having an awful performance. You would see flashes of stuff like he's really quick. And I mean, all the stuff that now we're seeing result in what he's been doing this season. But yeah, I mean, that's a huge leap. I will say I'm a bit surprised that Brandon Ingram didn't really move up given how impressed I've been with his season this year. But maybe it's just not – maybe the numbers aren't there to back it up. Team wins maybe?
So I'm stubborn. No way.
Like we've never figured that one out after being on a pod with you for the past.
No, I am very consciously trying to not be reactive to like recency. Sure. So are there players that I might be slow on like really recognizing stuff that they've done? Yeah, maybe. I mean, the other part of it is I'd be lying to you if I told you I'd watched a ton of Pelicans recently. So that, I mean, that probably, you know, in sort of an interim list, maybe that's a spot that I didn't study as much as I might doing like the full, like off season when you have time to really sit with it process. And there's a few, like, I think like in retrospect, I probably had like, maybe I had a few players that I could have dropped down a little bit more for having not as good seasons. And, you know, there's here or there, but yeah, like,
there's been a lot of injuries this year. I mean, I get it. And with Brandon Ingram, and maybe this is just the difference between him and Ja, it hasn't been as meteoric. It's been really good, but he has steadily just been getting better. Whereas Ja, I mean, he's, you know, it's superstar caliber.
No, like, Ja's, like, frankly, we've talked enough about him, but he's a guy that I had to slow myself down on. Like, I was like, you know, there's been times this year, like, I think we've talked about this, like, is Ja a top 10 player in the league right now?
Yes.
And.
Yes. I don't know if that messes up your tears, but it feels like
No, I don't.
Because that's what matters, right? Yeah. Does it feel like it? Yeah.
It does, but then you look at it, it's like, is Ja really better than Rudy Gobert? Is Ja really better than Chris Paul? Is Ja, like, this is, the playoffs are going to be huge for him. Like, he's a guy who, if they make a deep playoff run and he's dominant, he's a guy who could jump into tier one, certainly.
Yeah. I guess anybody that you expect to make the list that isn't on the list right now, that you're like, this person is just going to be on the list at the end of the season, no matter what I do.
Well, I mean, I think there's a few of, I got pushback from some people for not like mentioning Herb Jones as like one of the rookies who's been really good. And that's completely fair. I think he's most likely going to be in tier five, but he's certainly someone who's going to be there. Yeah, I don't know. It's other people who I was surprised.
I mean, Mobley is likely to be on the list. Is what, you know, I'm guessing.
Oh, I thought you were about to say I was going to be.
Oh,
on
yeah,
the list.
Yeah, yeah. Mo was going to be on the list.
No, Mobley. I have Mobley on there, don't I?
Oh, did I miss him? Man, I got to. Did I not? Done
Well, yeah, no, I have him in tier three.
Okay,
I have Mobley like at the same level as like, you know, Zion and LaMelo Ball and Anthony Edwards. So I'm certainly bullish on Evan Mobley, and that's a little bit of like, for rookies, this is like methodologically, like, rookies are the one kind of class of players I tend to give a little bit of a, okay, rookies are bad and next year they'll be substantially better. Even if the numbers don't improve from a, you know, a box score standpoint, they'll know how to play basketball better. And so that's, I think, you know, Evan Mobley and Cade Cunningham and Scotty Barnes and Josh Giddey, like, you can name a bunch of rookies who've been really productive this year, who I think are going to be on the list for years to come.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts from you guys this week?
Yeah. For anybody that's going to go at Seth for this list, go make your own. Okay. And then figure out how you're going to do all of that and put all the work into it. Okay.
But I will say that, like, if, you know, I tongue in cheek say, oh, I hate your favorite team. This by nature, this is like designed to be sort of an antidote to like over optimism. So it's very much a win in doubt. Like, tie does not go to the rudder when I'm doing these, because I think we have a tendency. It's like, oh, he's a, you know, if everyone named all the guys they think are top 10 players, but if they say, oh, like, if you ask people who's a top 10 player and you didn't let them count on their fingers how many players they'd named, most people would get to 17 or 18. So, like, it just, like, if we're really talking, we really have to be, like, judicious and cruel, really, about who's making what. When in doubt, push them down. So, if when I say I hate your favorite player equally, that's what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, I have 30 guys in my top 20. It's the best. It's fun. It's supposed to be fun. Keep it fun. Keep it locked in to the Athletic NBA show. We got Saturday Slam and Jam coming up this weekend. Of course, the Daily Ding coming back next week. For Seth and Mo, I am Dave. Thank you guys for listening to Nerder, She Wrote, on the Athletic NBA show.
Understand that, like, there are things you're going to disagree. That's fine. But you would people have a go at these lists in that sense and make it seem like, yo, we're just throwing darts and whatever, just figuring it out. It's a large undertaking.